see the thing double or triple, because I think that project, we're covered by four analysts, and I think most of them have PNAV numbers on these projects that, as I said, are very well advanced projects that are in the 0.2, 0.3 range. So you could easily see a jump to a number more traditionally associated to where we are in that Lassonde curve at 0.6 or some number like that, without sort of crazy arm waving about where the stock is going. I think that's just sort of a natural thing. I think everybody involved in the uranium business would say that project's going to get built, and it's going to get built today at $86, which is where the term price is. We don't need it to be 100 or 120.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the price is going to, well, this is my opinion only, the price is going to go significantly higher. I'm talking just the term price for uranium and the spot price. Mark Henderson, Laramide Resources. Good morning to you, my friend. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great, Andy. Nice to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Welcome on the show. Give me a 30,000-foot view here of Laramide Resources, and I'll go over the questions that I typically ask to all of my the companies that I have on the show. So give me a 30,000-foot view here.
Sure. Yeah. In brief, we are a developer, uranium developer. And so our mission, if you will, and has been for a while, is to be a multi-asset supplier of choice to the utilities. Probably, I don't want to call them the Western utilities, but let's call them the non-nation state utilities that typically have their own way to procure uranium. And that's a very vibrant market, and it's a growing market, and it's a tremendous story at the moment because the demand profile is pretty much locked in between now and 2040, based on all the nuclear power plants that are already up and running. Plus, you're probably hearing a lot about with the AI boom about the newfangled reactor designs, SMRs, various descriptions of them. That's all sort of a cherry on top on the demand picture. So it's a very prospective space, very long duration space. But the good thing is the demand is strong as far as you could see, basically. And so we are one of the companies that wants to be a solution to the supply side of that problem.
Got it. You said a key word here. You said developer, and we're going to get that to that in a minute. Mark, where are your projects at? I went to your website, and I know, but I want you to answer that question for all of our viewers and listeners.
Sure. Yeah. So I would say there's sort of three main silos, if you will. Two big development projects in Australia, number one, in the United States, number two, which is very fortuitous given everything that the current administration is doing to sort of get behind nuclear. And then number three, and this is a greenfield thing for those of your viewers that understand the exploration cycle, if you will. There's brownfield and greenfield. This is really generative stuff, looking for brand new deposits, which we desperately need. And we have gone into the country of Kazakhstan for that. And we have a very nice early entry position there.
Got it. Okay. So tell me, since you're a developer, tell me what you have known in the ground, and are you looking to expand that resources? I assume you are.
Yes. So in Australia, we have a project that was originally a Rio Tinto project going way back when, and there's many things in uranium that are legacy projects that were discovered in previous cycles that are only now just getting to the market, either because of demand or one thing or another. And that's a very big project that would be a top 10 global uranium mine. The most recent economic study, which is a little old now, we'll be freshening that up here probably in 26, has that at probably in the range of 3 to 5 million pounds. We did some work in 24. Basically did a nice bump on the resource, and that we think that supports a number closer to 5 million pounds a year, which would make that kind of a top 10 global uranium mine. There's been a lot of technical work done. Everything's known. The metallurgy is all known. It's a very low technical risk project, open pit project. It's remote. It's in Northwest Queensland. And that would be, if you will, probably the, if you were to put an NPV model on the company, that would be the highest value thing if you basically ascribe the same NPV discount or number across the whole portfolio in terms of what the NPV value would be, just because of the scale. The nature of uranium is there really aren't that many projects that are that level and higher. We're quite reliant in the business on quite a few large projects and quite a few large suppliers. The second project is big ISR. For those of your viewers that don't know what that is, that's in-situ recovery. It's basically solution mining. It's the way that some 40% of all the uranium in the world is produced, mainly by the country of Kazakhstan. And we have a very good United States project that, again, has a nice provenance. It was originally drilled out by a division of General Electric back in the original uranium boom in the 1970s, and it's kind of ready for prime time now. And that's a project that has roughly 50 million pounds of resource. The Australian one has, forgot to mention the number, but it's about 65 million pounds of resource M&I. And that
Those two
started.
big, I'm interrupting you. So really two, those two
They're pretty big
companies,
as
those
the
are pretty big. Got it. Go ahead.
peer group comparatives go. But the ISRs typically come in a phased fashion, and ours would be no different. It comes in, and we have an NRC license on it, which basically sets out the conditions for which it can be brought online. And that comes on at 1 million pounds a year and then scales up from there in kind of increments and phases, if you will, up to ultimately 3 million pounds. We have a license to produce 3 million pounds a year in a specific location in New Mexico. And the Kazakhstan stuff is brand new greenfield, exciting territory, very large land package that we were able to go and get involved in, all around one of the two main trends there, production trends in southern Kazakhstan that has an awful lot of mines on it that are currently producing. As I said before, Kazakhstan's the world's largest producer, and I think they have 19 separate operations that are all in situ recovery. They really in the country have not done any exploration per se since they started to produce, because all the original resource was effectively found by the Russians in the 80s before the breakup of the Soviet Union. And so they've been kind of living off this fantastic endowment that was already discovered. And there really hasn't been a lot of greenfield there, and there kind of needs to be. I mean, we're basically just going to go at the limits of where the existing things are and hopefully have some success, finding some new resource there.
Got it. Questions about all three jurisdictions. You said a couple of things. You said that you are a developer and you have a license to mine. So where, how far out are you to production in Australia and the US?
Well, let me start with the U.S. The U.S. is kind of a more of a known. And I would say that because we have an NRC license, which is all the federal permitting, we need one state license, which is the last permit that we're working on. And we're now actively engaged in trying to get that. We applied and were granted status in this so-called Fast 41 projects that they're trying to fast track in order to get various things in the United States up, particularly things they have where they think they have either supply chain vulnerability, economic vulnerability, what have you. Like, everybody's heard about the rare earths issue that obviously is top of mind at the moment. So the permitting timeline, according to that Fast 41 schedule that, it's all in the public domain, has us Q2 with sort of final permits in hand being shovel ready. And then it's about probably a year to build it, given the nature of what we're building. So
Okay, let
this
me
is something that
interrupt
will
you.
be late, in the late 20s, no matter what, is kind of a realistic timeline. Australia is a little different because the project is super technically advanced. We frankly don't need to know anything else, but there's been a quirk in Australia around various governments that like or don't like uranium. And so we transitioned from one that didn't, and we're back in one that is okay with it, we think now, but they sort of haven't given the final nod. I say we're on the 1 yard line because it really requires a one statement out of the premier of the state that this project is in. And then this will go very fast through the permitting process and then ultimately built. But realistically, that's more late 20s
Okay.
if everything went smoothly. But it's a very well-known project, and coveted, I would say, by other people in the industry. We have a 20% shareholder, being another company in our industry that obviously saw the potential of this. They're an Australian company. As I said, it's a highly valuable asset within our space.
Got it. Okay, so I just want to make sure for clarity, you're 1 to 3 years out, realistically three, but you should have, assuming things go the way we think they are, you should be it should be a go to start building probably within the next year, correct?
Well, I think, I mean, most optimistically, we'd be able to break ground in 27 on the
27.
American project. And that project is of a similar scale to all the other peer group comparables that are currently either starting up or have already started up. That really is their production profile typically. But that a lot of those cap out at 1 million. We have a much bigger resource because we have a 50 million pound resource. And I
Right.
would say in terms of peer group comparables timeline wise, uranium is a bit of an unusual industry because they're really, the demand to some extent is super highly inelastic, as you could imagine, because it's tied to whether you're going to build a giant nuclear power plant or even a mini nuclear power plant. And once you know that, that's it. There isn't any price elasticity beyond that. But we're fortunate that that's a good case. But on the supply side, it's similarly, everything takes a long time, and there's probably a handful of projects of any scale whatsoever between now and 2030 startup. So it may sound to the uninitiated like that's a long timeline. That's actually a pretty reasonable timeline. And
Yeah, I would say it's actually quite short. And to all my viewers and listeners, I'm just asking these questions really how it relates to the Lassonde curve. Mark, it seems like you're really at the start of, if you would, the Lassonde curve being this. You're right in here, if you would, about ready to go up. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I think in the US, yeah, there'll be an inflection point. I think even before we sort of break ground, I think because also the beauty of ISR is it's very, really quite low CapEx because you're just basically drilling an initial well field and the process infrastructure you need is quite modest compared to, you've got a giant copper mine that has a flotation circuit or you've got a gold mine that has all the associated things that go with that, including a tailings facility now, which tends to be one of the bigger CapEx items in a lot of these projects. We don't have any of that because of the nature of what you're doing. So, I mean, our CapEx on the number when we did the PEA with a little over a year ago was $50 million on the project to get phase one up. So, and it also goes quickly because of the nature of what you're doing. Again, because you don't have a lot of civil, and I mean, obviously it's in a very good location. There's a road right to it. You don't have all the civils on the engineering side, and you don't have things like tailings dams. So it tends to be a thing that can get up and running relatively quickly, which is quite positive. And for the sequencing that we want, obviously makes sense because project one helps facilitate the much bigger, more traditional mine that would eventually come along in Australia, which is a much bigger CapEx number.
Got it. So I think I already know the answer to this question, but I want you to answer it anyways. Let's talk about infrastructure, roads, power, that sort of thing. Do you have to build anything or is it pretty turnkey?
Well, in the US, fantastic, obviously. It's in the, you're never far in an American state away from any real infrastructure. Australia is more typically what you'd expect in a site in that country. And virtually, and not all mines, but most of the mines in Australia are what they say is fly in, fly out with rosters of workforce and everything else. So the good news is that they really understand it well and they know how to do it. And there's lots of people that do it, and there's lots of engineering companies and everything else. And what we're doing is, even though it's uranium, which is just the little back end of what you're producing as ultimately as the commodity, the nature of everything else you're doing is been done a million times in Australia. An open pit mine with trucks, really low strip ratio, pretty simple plant. That there's there'll be more civils on that one again, but the infrastructure, relatively speaking, is pretty good.
Got it. Talk to me about grade here. I am, as I often say, I'm not a geologist. What is high grade for uranium, if you would, and what grade are you guys?
That, Andy, is a great question, and it's a bit of a it's I think a bit of a misconception for people that look at this space when they sort of come to it from that lens that maybe they understand good the gold business. And I've been in the gold business before and been involved in gold and silver things and everything else. And more grade is always better, typically, and
Yeah,
so
but not
people
with
get mesmerized.
uranium.
Yeah,
I'll interrupt
people.
you. I understand where you're going, and not with uranium. You do want high grade, but not with uranium because it can get dangerous.
Well, I was going in a little different direction. So the other thing is there's unlike in gold where, more is always better, even if it's underground or open pit, typically you're moving dirt, moving material, volumetric kind of thing. So more is typically better. But the very nature of what what I discussed earlier with ISR, because the whole process is completely different with solution mining and everything else. The economics are all built around completely different things. So, we have these mines in Athabasca that are, I can't remember what the grade is, but we're in the
Crazy grade. Yeah.
percents, like percents of underground thing. And obviously, you need robots to mine it and all the rest of it in some cases.
Yeah.
Kazakhstan, the average grade of Kazakhstan is I think between 600 and 800 ppm, which is
Okay.
0.08.
Right.
Most open pit mines, most underground, no gold mine would make it at that. But that if you're using what the rule of thumb is, those grades are really pretty fantastic. Namibia, for example, is probably half of that. We are with our Westmoreland thing in Australia, we're like 0.08, 0.09. So we're 800, 900 ppm. So we're probably at least twice Namibia, just to give you a comparative.
Yeah.
So that's really the more relevant comparative. And our ISR projects in the US are similar to grades in Kazakhstan.
Got it. I think the better question is that the higher the grade, I want to make, correct me if I'm wrong, it's like the less, the more trickier it is to get out of the ground there or to mine just because of environmental reasons and just safety, correct?
Sure. Yeah. Can you hold on 1 second? I think we just have.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I'm on a
I'm just going to
podcast.
hold up my hand for my
Yeah.
producer to cut this out.
Yeah, I just need 15 minutes of super quiet. Okay.
Yeah, no
Thanks for that.
problem.
I thought
Yeah.
that would happen.
No, go back to that is like, so the higher the grade, the trickier it is for environmental reasons and the more costly. I don't, man, I want to make sure I use my words correct. There's just a different component with uranium when it comes to grade, correct? Yeah.
That
Correct.
no that there there no absolutely there is kind of a, well, particularly for underground mines, and the issue really is around ventilation and people being exposed to it,
Yeah.
which is why I had mentioned earlier about the robots. So they've come up with some incredible technology that is involved in these deep mines that Cameco built, and that also freezes a lot of the stuff in place first, because you've basically got a super saturated sandstone that you effectively could put your finger through the core. If you saw a piece of core from some of this stuff, a lot of times you can poke your finger right through it.
Right.
So they need ways to both make it stable enough to mine it, and then figure out a way to mine it. And the old rule of thumb in underground mines was like sort of 0.5 was the sweet spot where you had a lot of grade, but you got less ventilation issues. If you scale up from there, you're into more cost,
Right.
because ventilation has to be a lot better. And a lot of the legacy issues you heard about in uranium mining were really around practices that probably aren't being done the way they would ever do it today in terms of ventilation.
Yep, got
Yeah.
it. So let's talk really about share structures and cash that you have in the bank and how much you or the insiders have invested and who you have invested in. Answer those questions. What's your share structure? How many shares do you have outstanding, fully diluted?
So I think the primary is about 280. There's very little dilution on top of that. There's literally no warrants anymore. I think we're down to just, there's a few broker warrants from the last round, and that's it. There's no other warrant overhang at all. We did have quite a lot, and we've effectively burned through all that now, and we're very mindful not to do that. The last two raises we did were done without warrants. And then there's probably less than 10 million options on top of that.
Okay.
Insiders own probably around 10. I'm the biggest shareholder out of that group. I probably own as a percentage of the company more than any other uranium CEO that I'm aware of, just because I've been at it a long time and the stock was quite attractively valued for a long time, and we took advantage of that. And obviously, we also eat our own cooking and believe in
Sure.
it. We do have a 20% shareholder in the form of this Australian company called Boss Energy, and they are a
Yep.
big ISR producer in Australia. That's producing now, and they're obviously mentally, they're looking for growth project number two. So as I said before, one of the big things about our company that's a bit unique too is we sort of have that whole portfolio thing already done. Everybody else that's up and running is eventually going to be looking for project number two.
Yeah.
And so in addition to that, we probably have the ETFs, and there's multiple ETFs now. The three biggest ones were in all of those. That's probably, I want to say, 15% of the structure.
Okay.
We probably have another 10 to 15 of traditional institutions, a lot of the typical names that own the uranium names, the big ones that are people that are well known. And then the rest would be retail, and it's retail all over the place.
Okay, excellent. So how much cash do you have in the bank, and are you fully funded to get you through to really through the next year through 26?
We did a financing in the summer, raised 12.
12 million.
We probably have 6 or 7 now left. And
Got it.
but most of what we're doing is permitting. There'll be initially inevitably be more fundraising at some point down the track. I think we're looking for more creative ways, maybe besides just constantly doing equity, given we think the equity is pretty undervalued to do things. Like there's not much royalty overhang, in particular on the Australian project. There's other things we can do effectively. There's at some point a lot of these historically these uranium developers got developed with some form of either not utility involvement, Japanese trading house involvement, et cetera. The end users need this stuff, and they've actually, in my view, been a little bit too cautious about trying to ensure that the supply part of this equation is moving ahead quickly, because I think we're kind of behind the curve. And if you listen to folks that are now, the kind of considered the most knowledgeable folks about it in the sector, and they're talking about this all the time. I mean, Rick Rule and Mike Galkin and people like that, all the other hedge guys, and that are the uranium gurus. I mean, it's kind of a common thematic. So there's a lot of different ways to do that. And as I said, we're not close to being pushing the button on the production money. So, that's at least 15 months out, probably 12, 15 months out. So you don't have that ahead of you.
Right, got it. Okay, so do you have take me through probably through the end of this quarter through next quarter? Do you have a catalyst, or do you have news that you can talk about that investors should be paying attention to and being aware of?
100%. I would say the two biggest catalysts is one we do control, which is we're going to be drilling for the first time in Kazakhstan. I think that's a pretty exciting program. You get a lot of value for money in Kazakhstan. So we're going to, I think, drill between 15 and 18,000 meters is scheduled. We're just waiting for one final approval, and then that's ready to go with multiple rigs. So there'll be news flow coming out of that. And I'm certainly very excited to see what the possibilities are there. I mean, we're not looking for something small there. I mean, you don't go to Kazakhstan to try and find 20 million pound deposits. You go there to try and find something that at least looks like a church rock, which is 50 million pounds. And then I'd say the other one, which we don't control, but as I said, we're on the 1 yard line, we think. And an announcement that suddenly green light go in Queensland, let's develop uranium mines. I think that's the number one catalyst that would supercharge the stock. And really, you could see the thing double or triple, because I think that project, we're covered by four analysts, and I think most of them have PNAV numbers on these projects that, as I said, are very well advanced projects that are in the 0.2, 0.3 range. So you could easily see a jump to a number more traditionally associated to where we are in that Lassonde curve at 0.6 or some number like that. Without sort of crazy arm waving about where the stock could go, I think that's just sort of a natural thing, and I think we get the benefit of people looking at it through the lens that it's going to happen now. I mean, I think if we had that approval, I think everybody involved in the uranium business would say that project's going to get built, and it's going to get built today at $86, which is where the term price is. We don't need it to be 100 or 120.
Yeah, and the price is going to, well, this is my opinion only. The price is going to go significantly higher. I'm talking just the term price for uranium and the spot price. So, Mark, if, well, let me talk to all my viewers and listeners here. So, I look for in evaluating any project, I like to see a tight share structure, if you would. It really just depends on where they're at, if they're an explorer or developer. There's not really a number I like to put on that, but be relatively tight. I do think that you're relatively tight, if you would, just considering that you're a developer in your share structure. Another thing to all my viewers and listeners, I like to see at least minimum $1 million in the bank, but obviously the more the better. I like to see a $5 to $10 million range. That typically means that you're fully funded through the rest of the year, or any projects that you have on that you have in unplanned, if you would. And then I really like to see three projects. And to all my viewers and listeners, I like to see three projects. The reason for that is that it makes it even more attractive for a major or a a mid-level developer producer to purchase the company. Not that this is going to be purchased, but I like for a company to have options, either taking it to a mind or be snapped up to by another company. So they check those boxes for me. I am not as an investor as of yet, but that certainly can change and very well could change in the next several weeks after this interview has been dropped. I will buy if I buy in the open market, just like all of you guys. Mark, if people wanted to know more information about you, what is your website? What exchanges are you traded on? And what are your ticker symbols?
The symbol's LAM. So it's www.laramide.com. It's the full name of the company. And we are on the Toronto Stock Exchange, the ASX, the Australian Stock Exchange, and on OTC Bulletin Board or
Got it.
QB.
Yep, got it. I'll put all of this in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify, so people can trade you. Mark, I want to thank you so much for your time.
No, thanks, Andy. I enjoyed it.
Yep, take care.
Thanks.